Lecture on the life of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Sheikh Muhammad Baig.
حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل ونعم المولى ونعم النصير أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين أما بعد The fourth Imam, he is known as زين العابدين The ornament of the worshippers, Sayyidu Sajideen, the chief of all those who make sajda, Sajjad, the one who makes excessive sajdas, and Zul Sakanat. These are the alqab, the titles of Imam. His birth, there's controversy regarding the birth, and which is obviously regarding every imam. We see that there are different dates that have been mentioned. Two dates are mentioned for the fourth imam, the 15th of Jamadil Ula and the 5th of Shaban. And obviously these differences are because of the severe political situation where the companions of the imams were not able to give the news of the imams to the rest of the believers. And because of that, we see the differences are there in the narrations that have come down to us in regards to the birth of the imams or the shahadat of the imams. But when we see this imam, we will see that this imam is the only imam whose mother is Persian. The only imam whose mother is Persian. The mother of our imam was by the name of Shahrbano alayha salam. And she was the daughter of the king of Iran by the name of Yazdegerd the Third, or Yazdegerd the Third. It is said regarding her in our history and in our riwayat that when she was a princess, she had a dream and Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam visit her in a dream. And she had given Islam to her and explained Islam to her. Now obviously, you know, who else can describe Islam better than Hazrat Fatima? And to her, it wasn't any doubt in her own words that she had said that she had accepted the truth when it came, and she saw it very clearly. And as she accepted the truth and became a Muslim and submitted to Allah, then she had another dream in which the Prophet of Allah came, and he introduced Imam Hussein and proposed marriage for Imam Hussein to her. She accepted the marriage, and it is said that the Prophet recited their akd in her dream. This was the akd that was recited by the Prophet, and hence it was told to her that soon the Muslim army would conquer your father's kingdom, and you will be brought as a slave to Medina. And it was told to her, do not worry, because no one will touch you until you reach my son Hussein. And it so happened that when she came as a slave, it was in calmness. Usually when you are taken as a slave and captured, you are worried, you are frantic, you don't know what's going to happen to you, where you're going to end up. But the people who brought her there, they saw that in her there was a calmness, as if she was so sure where she's going to go and that nothing is going to happen to her. And when she came to the market, to the slave market, it was Imam, it is said that a companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam, salawat alayhi, who was appointed by Imam Ali al-Islam in his khilafat to rule over the eastern provinces, saw them and he took them and brought them to Imam Ali, her and her sister. Both of them came there. And Shahrbano, or her other name being Shahizanan, she was given to Imam Hussein. She was asked, who would you like to marry? Imam Ali asked both of them, who would you like to marry? And she replied in return, I would like to marry someone who has no one else above him. And that's why Imam Ali said, such a person is only my son Hussein. Go and you can be his wife. He was married to Hussein, and the other sister who came with her, she became the wife of Muhammad ibn Abu Bakr, the other, the one who Imam Ali always regarded as a son. And she became the wife, Imam Ali, he told Imam Hussein that take special care of her, because she is going to be the mother of the best of all the worshippers. And this is something over here, I want to stop a bit over here just to make us understand you see, everything the imams say, we should not just let it pass by without any reflection on it. It needs to be understood what their wisdom is and what they want to teach us in regards to that. Obviously, Imam Hussein knows the ilm al-ghayb that Imam Ali has, and it wasn't for Imam Hussein that Imam Ali is trying to say this, that you take care of her and be kind to her and look after her, because she is going to be the mother of the best of worshippers. It was a lesson for all of mankind that in order for us to have children that are great, it is very important that how Imam Ali advises Imam Hussein to take care of her, be kind to her, raise her up in respect and honor, so that when she will have children, they will be honorable children. In other words, if we want to have honorable children, then we need to give honor to the mothers before they have the children. Before the mother has the children, give them honor, give them respect, so that when they have children, those children will also be honorable and respectable and dignified. Otherwise, the fact is that if we try to put down the mother all the time, if you say things about the mother or try to make her look or belittle her, the children that she will produce also will become dishonorable, just the way that you treated the mother. This is why it's so important Imam Ali is advising Imam Hussein that look after the wife, make sure that your wife is held up in honor and respected, because you want a woman who feels respected, who is dignified, to have children, because those children will be dignified also. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. And hence we see that the fact that a Muslim, that before Imam Hussein was introduced, when we see her testimony, Shahrbano's testimony in regards to the dreams that she had of Bibi Fatima and the Prophet, we see that before Imam Hussein was introduced to her, we see that it was Bibi Fatima who came and introduced Islam to her first. So that she submits to Allah, that she understands from her depth of her soul that this is the truth, and she submits to the soul, to that truth that is in Islam. We have a riwayat, in our ziyarat, we give testimony to this. I read Ziyarat-e-Waritha the other day. Now I'll just read another ziyarat, which has the same meaning that Allah is implying in this. For those, the lineage through which Imamat came down, all the Imams, they came down. When you look at the lineage, it is said, we are giving testimony that the wombs and the loins through which your light has come. We're speaking to Ahlul Bayt and saying, oh Ahlul Bayt, we are giving testimony that the wombs and the loins through which your genes have come and your lineage has come, Allah has never, it has never passed the eyes of Allah, and that Allah was looking after those wombs and looking after those loins in order to make sure that your light remains purified, and every generation before you of your father and grandfather going up, you can make sure that Allah has made sure that your light has been purified. And hence, if any mother of the Imam has come, it was first that she was purified before she became the mother of the Imam. This is what we believe in through our ideology and through the ziyarat that we have, that we testify to. And hence, when we look at Imam, just I want to go through the titles of the Imam, a few, and inshallah, you know, say something regarding the akhlaq and the method of the Imam in his life that he led, so that it becomes clear for us and we can take some lessons from it. If you send me aloud, salawat. The first title we will discuss is the fact that Imam was given this title, Sayyidus Sajideen, or Sajjad. These are titles that Imam was given. Now why was he called this? What was the reason behind this?
Sheikh Muhammad Baik.
I praise Allah for sending me you, my love. You found your home, it's here with me, and I'm here with you. Now let me let you know. You've opened my heart. I was always thinking that love was wrong, but everything was changed when you came along.
Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam. He says that my father, meaning Imam Sajjad, my father, whenever he used to think of Allah's blessings, he would fall into sajda. Whenever Allah used to protect him from the enemies, he used to fall in sajda. Whenever Allah used to give him trials, he used to fall in sajda. Whenever Allah used to give him a tawfiq, he would fall into sajda. And he would fall into extended sajda. In other words, obviously to us it's mustahab, even after we pray, we make sajda shukr. But when we get trials also, do we fall into sajda and say, thank you for this trial? When we get hardship from Allah, do we fall into trial? Whenever the Imam used to get hardship, he used to fall in sajda. And it became such that the greatest of all trial, because our ulama and our historians and even the riwayat that we see that we have, it has been mentioned there also that the Imam who faced the greatest trials in his life, if you look at the history of all the Imams, it is Imam Zainul Abidin. Imam Hussein's trial was just in the first 10 days of Muharram. In fact, the last 3 days of Muharram, when the water was cut out, then you see the trials began. Imam Hussein knew what he was going to face. In 3 days, those trials ended. Imam became shaheed and he went towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But it was from that point onward that we see Imam Sajjad took the reins of the tragedy and went through all the places of ignominy, through Kufa and Sham, and through the hardships that they went through. It was Imam Zainul Abidin who faced that. Imam Hussein had seen Karbala. Imam Sajjad had also seen Karbala. But you see, when Imam Sajjad was asked, where is the greatest trial you face? He said, Asham, Asham, Asham. In other words, the trials of Karbala truly began after Karbala. The hardship began after that. And when that trial was given to Imam Sajjad. I want you to see this, my friends. Just see what Imam Sajjad is going to. When this trial was given, when was it given? When he was given the imamate. As soon, where did his imamate start? No other imam started his imamate in such a precarious situation. No imam started in such a precarious situation. Imagine this. All the imams, they began their imamate. Yes, their father was shaheed. But you see that shahadat was just him. That grief is there. But the fact that the Ahl Bayt, the family of the Prophet, is just killed and only remains the woman and you are the only man. In that situation, Imam Sajjad started his imamate and his trial. And the first thing he did when he gained consciousness, on Sham-e Ghariba, when he was taken out of his tent and he came out of his unconscious state and he gained that consciousness, the first thing that he did, knowing the situation around him, more than anyone else, he understood what has happened. More than anyone, he has understood what is going to happen. With all of that trial in front of him, the first thing he did is went into sajda and thanked Allah. My friends, making sajda in your home on carpet, where everything is nice and everything is taken care of, is one sajda. But when you make a sajda like Imam Sajjad has made sajda on Sham-e Ghariba, then you are known as Sayyidu Sajideen. This is Sayyidu Sajideen. You are the chief of those who prostrate. The best sajda was made by you. Look at your sajda of thanks. You know, one sajda was made by Imam Hussein. And that was a sajda of shahadat, sajda of ita'at. And one sajda was made by Imam Sajjad. Let me just put it in ideological terms if you send me salawats. You know, there is a wajib sajda we make in prayers. Sajda is wajib in prayers. We make wajib sajda in prayers. When we pray to Allah and do itaat and ibadat, in ibadat, sajda is wajib. Two sajdas are wajib in every rakat. We make that sajda. That sajda that we make there. Then there's one sajda that we make after the prayer. After the prayer, we make another sajda. That is the sajda of shukr, the sajda of asking and seeking from Allah, making dua to Allah. Right? That is a mustahab sajda we make. Right? And both those sajdas Allah wanted from us. Both of those positions Allah wanted from us. That's why when we declared in the Quran, when we read Surah Fatiha, we said, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. Only you do we worship, and only you do we ask for help. The height of worship is sajda. And the height of asking help from Allah is also sajda. Now both of these sajdas make the true obedience and submission to Allah. Both these sajdas are required. In Karbala, we saw both these sajdas. The only thing, one sajda of ibadat was made by Hussein, one sajda of shukr was made by Sajjad. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. This is where Imam Hussein had ended his ibadat. Imam Sajjad began his shukr. This is why Sayyidu Sajideen. Only you could have made that sajda in that position. You could have thanked Allah in that position. Only you have made that. No one else has done it. Sayyidu Sajideen. This is the first title of Imam Sajjad. The second title of Imam Sajjad is Zainul Abideen. This is also a title of Imam Sajjad, Zainul Abideen. There are different riwayat regarding why he got this title. We read one riwayat from Abdullah ibn Abbas, who reports from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Wherein he has said that the Prophet mentioned that on the Day of Judgment, a caller will call out. Everyone will be gathered and a caller will call out, Aina Zainul Abideen? Where is Zainul Abideen, the ornament of all the worshippers? Where is the beauty of all the worshippers? Zainul Abideen, not just a title, my friend, but a reality. Of all the worshippers that have worshipped Allah, where is the ornament, the beauty of all that worship? And everyone in Mahshar will be looking around to see who has done that worship, whose worship has become the zenith and the ornament of all the worshippers. And it is at that time the Prophet said that as if I see my son Ali ibn Hussein walking out from the people of Mahshar, dignified and honored, and coming forward, and the people will look at this and say, so this is where the zenith and the ornament of all worship was. Zainul Abideen. This title is given to him because truly he was Zainul Abideen. It is said from Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. That another reason for this title, and all of these reasons are together the same that we can look at, Zainul Abideen. It was at night when the Imam used to pray and he was offering his tahajjud namaz-e-shab. And shaitan wanted to distract him. Yeah. Shaitan knew that this is Zainul Abideen. He knew that this is Sayyidu Sajideen. And he knew that Allah is going to pride himself over all the creation in regards to this person's ibadat. Meaning that Allah also, when you pray to him, as I said, Allah loves it when someone prays to him sincerely. But if someone prays to him like Imam Sajjad does, then obviously the pride that Allah has in a servant like this, he wants to let it be known to the world. So shaitan, when he heard that this is Sayyidu Sajideen, Zainul Abideen, so he said, you know what, let me go and distract him in his prayers so that when he's distracted, I can claim the one you call Sayyidu Sajideen. You see, this is what I was able to do to him. So Shaitan, he came in the form of a snake. You know, jinn, because they're made of fire, they can take any shape. And he came in the form of a snake. Imam Sajjad was offering his tahajjud prayer. And he came and he bit the toe of Imam Sajjad. The snake, obviously, the shape of the snake was obviously one that is fearful. Imam Sajjad, the way he was praying, did not even flinch or was bothered. He kept on going. And Shaitan tried as much as he could to bother him, to get his mind off of prayers. And Imam Sajjad kept on going. Now, my friends, just here, just to make it a little bit real for us, so that we can understand the situation. If we were praying and a frog came in front of us, not a snake, I won't even go that far. A frog came in front of us, or a lizard came in front of us, you know, will our mind be on prayers and Allah, or is our mind going to go to that frog and see where is he going to jump next? Understand, I'm not giving an example of a snake. Not a snake that is coming to bite you also. That's a whole different thing. Imam Sajjad, as he prayed on. The snake is biting his toe, the big toe. And he prayed on as if nothing is happening. He just goes on without any bothersome. He prays. And after all that he tried, after Imam ended his prayers, he looked at the snake and said, "Go away. Go away." And the snake, looking at that, after all the tricks he tried, that Shaitan left there. When he left there, Shaitan, it is said that he declared, "Surely, surely, anta Zainul Abideen. You are Zainul Abideen." Yeah, I've tried all my tricks. Everything I have in the bag, I tried. But not even close to even paying attention. You are so engaged and engrossed in prayers that your mind and soul is with Allah. I can understand why Allah is calling you Zainul Abideen. Allah, Allah.
This was lecture on the life of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Sheikh Muhammad Baig.
Allahu Akbar, la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
At least 200 healthcare workers have been kidnapped from Gaza during the Zionist regime's war, which has been the deadliest for doctors in recorded history. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The killing of senior Palestinian doctor Iyad Rantisi recently revealed to have happened back in November after he was taken into detention by the Zionist regime forces has predictably triggered outrage. Yet, the murder of kidnapped doctors is only one of various components to the Zionist regime's systematic assault on the health sector in the besieged Gaza Strip. Dr. Iyad Rantisi was killed at Shikma prison 6 days after being kidnapped from the Gaza Strip at a checkpoint that he was trying to pass, attempting to flee south in order to avoid Israel's intense bombing campaign. Held without a charge, he was transferred to the Israeli jail, which is infamous for its Shin Bet interrogation facility. While the specific cause of his death has not been revealed, the assumption is that he was likely tortured to death." Dr. Rantisi was the director of the Women's Hospital segment of Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza's Beit Lahia. He was only 53 years old. Dr. Adnan Al-Borsh, another prominent Palestinian physician and surgeon, was also kidnapped from Gaza and later tortured to death while in Israeli regime custody. He had led the orthopedic surgery department as its chief at Ashifa Hospital in Gaza City. As both of these murders of Palestinian doctors happened last year, but have only recently been confirmed, it is feared that many of the doctors and healthcare workers who have been kidnapped from Gaza may have also suffered the same fate. It is believed that at least 58 Palestinian prisoners have been killed in Israeli regime prison facilities since the start of the war on Gaza in October, yet only 18 have been identified. When it comes to the targeting of the health sector in Gaza, the case is crystal clear. According to Doctors Without Borders, 493 healthcare workers in the first 7 months of the war alone, while their own facilities and employees had personally experienced dozens of violent attacks. Only weeks into the war, after the Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, had ordered his forces to completely shut off all aid, electricity, water, and fuel, the many hospitals in Gaza began shutting down due to a lack of fuel. By the end of May 2024, the World Health Organization, WHO, and International Rescue Committee both reported that only a third of Gaza's hospitals maintained a partial operational capacity. The rest were completely shut down or destroyed. Prior to this, in northern Gaza, didn't possess a single operational hospital in December, according to the WHO. The Zionist regime also made the Ashifa Hospital the focus of the first phase of its ground operation in the Gaza Strip, receiving U.S. backing in its lies about the largest medical complex in the besieged coastal territory being a Hamas base. The Zionist regime inflicted various massacres against healthcare workers, patients, and refugees sheltering in the Ashifa Hospital, with the last invasion of the complex inflicting irreparable damage and leaving behind a mass grave of 300 crudely buried bodies that was discovered in April. After laying waste to Ashifa Hospital in Gaza City, the Zionist regime military set its sights on the city of Khan Yunis in December and would go on to make Nasser Hospital the center of its campaign in an area that they claimed was the real Hamas headquarters. And it predictably turned out that the allegations about the Nasser Hospital, also one of Gaza's largest medical complexes, were completely false. And when the Zionist regime occupation army withdrew, they left behind another mass grave containing over 320 bodies. At least 200 healthcare workers have been kidnapped from Gaza during the war, which has been the deadliest for doctors in recorded history. Horror stories of torture, assassinations, and injuries inflicted upon doctors in Gaza are seemingly never-ending. The besieged Gaza territory's healthcare sector has, by almost all metrics, collapsed, and the work of nurses and doctors is continuing under near impossible conditions.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, also in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Since we have started, dealing with some of the jurisprudential laws concerning Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question, because this is a widespread scene, and I think we need to pause and think about it or contemplate it a bit, and asking a religious scholar such as Ayatollah Khamenei what his view is regarding this practice or this ritual. What's his ruling in the matter of lashing oneself with chains as done by some Muslims?
Well, we need to understand the difference between chains and swords, or chains with knives attached to them. Okay, so when it comes to the lashing oneself with chains only, there is no problem. All the religious scholars, of course, agree that using chains to beat hit ourselves is allowed. But this word chains, when you use the word chain, in the Indian subcontinent, as I have mentioned it in the episodes, in some episodes, of course, they use the word zanjir. Zanjir is actually a Farsi word. It is used also in Urdu, and large numbers of Muslims living in India and Pakistan use the word zanjir. And when the word zanjir is used, it's usually understood as a chain with knives attached to it. So when they ask a religious authority as to what the Islamic law about zanjirs and is, of course, the religious authority, because of having the Farsi understanding and being under the impression that it means only zanjir, not only knives and swords, he says, okay, there's no problem in it. لا مانع منه, okay? Yes. And he says it's okay, there's no problem in it. But, of course, we need to understand that there is people who ask such questions, they don't mean that they hit themselves only with chains.
Yes.
They ask to get the question about qamazani or tatbir, and then they use the same answer to tell other people, okay,
yes,
there is certain religious authority has permitted.
I'll ask you something about that in the next part, inshallah. But about the chains, basically,
there's no problem.
There's no problem.
Sure.
On condition that they are not equipped with or attached with something else like
yes,
the swords or blades or
blades,
whatever, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Nice.
There is this question that I promised to ask, but let me ask it now. So what's the Islamic law about tatbir or gamazani?
Well, that is a very crucial, a very important and controversial question. And I should say that I have to say, and I have to give actually a short summary on the answer given by the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, when questions about tatbir and qamazani are asked. So the thing is that we need to understand what actually tatbir is. What is tatbir and what are the alternative words used by Shia Muslims? Tatbir is known as qamazani in some parts of the Shia world, and it's also known as talwarzani. You know, in the Indian subcontinent,
mm-hmm,
they use the word talwarzani. And, of course, the Shia Muslims in Pakistan also use the same word, and also Shia Muslims living in Bangladesh, so because they speak the same Urdu language. So no matter what word we use to talk about it, tatbir is a form of ritual bloodletting practiced today as an act of mourning by some Shia Muslims, of course. It is sometimes translated as self-flagellation,
yes,
which is, I think, a word which we shouldn't use at all, because this is a pure Christian concept. We shouldn't use the term self-flagellation.
Yes.
Self-flagellation is actually disciplinary and devotional practice of flogging oneself with whips or other instruments that inflict pain only. So self-flagellation is a pure Christian concept, in my opinion, also based on what I've studied. In Christianity, for example, self-flagellation is practiced in the context of the doctrine of the mortification of flesh. Mortification. And so it is seen as a spiritual discipline. Okay? But tatbir has nothing to do with the Christian concept of the mortification of flesh, and nor does it have anything to do with the prophetic tradition in Sunnah. So it is very much alien to Islam, alien to the prophetic tradition. So the concept of mourning during Ashura is actually to commemorate the event of Ashura, respect the symbols of the religion, and remember the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and his companions. And the chief of the martyrs, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, and his companions were the ones who stood up to defend Islam and prevent the destruction of the religion by the Umayyads, of course. And it is, of course, necessary to narrate the story of the sacrifices and to listen to those who narrate this story. And of course, the more importantly, the aim is to learn lessons from this tremendously important event, the event of Ashura.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, I asked you a question regarding tatbir or qamizani. Is there anything left regarding this actually ritual or this practice, as you mentioned, very much alien or unfamiliar to Shia school of thought?
Of course. The question is the practice of bloodletting considered a form of mourning, azadari?
Mm-hmm.
Can we consider it? Just to shed our blood and start flagellating ourselves? Of course not. It is not and it can never be a form of mourning,
mm-hmm.
according to the contemporary scholars, as far as I know, as far as I have studied. So we are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. And we should see that, has any one of the imams practiced tatbir? Has any one of the companions of the imam practiced in the early period of Islam?
Right.
Because that was the time of the imamah, that's the time of the, of the noble imams. So no one, of course, no one from the companions of the imams practiced tatbir.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been reported that Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam held mourning ceremonies in which he narrated the story of the sacrifices of the grandfather, of his grandfather, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salatu wasalam, did the same thing to commemorate the martyrdom of his father, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Of course, it is reported that Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salatu wasalam lived for more than 30 years after the martyrdom of his father.
Mm-hmm.
He shed tears, each time he remembered the suffering of his father.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, especially some of my Pakistani brothers, they give the example of Zainab hitting her head against the kajava. This analogy makes no sense to make such an analogy, because if anyone suffered the tragedy that Zainab salamullahi alayha suffered, the pain that she suffered, of course, he would have died on the spot.
Mm.
But Zainab, salamullahi alayha, of course, actually withstood the pain and suffering, and she carried the message forward. We do understand that Zainab, salamullahi alayha, is not in authority in when it comes to the religion and driving Islamic laws. Of course, the practice and the sayings of Zainab salamullah alayha, because she was not, and she's not considered to be one of the infallibles, so the Islamic Muslim scholars cannot infer their religious code of practice based on the sayings of Lady Zainab salamu alayha and based on her
mm-hmm.
conduct.
Okay.
Therefore, she is not considered to be an authority. She was not infallible, and her deeds and practices cannot be used to justify our actions in this time around. And so the main point is that, brothers and sisters, let us see what the religious scholars have to say in this regard. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has a statement in this regard. He has said in one of his fatawa, which I would like to read.
Would you?
Yes.
Please? Thank you very much.
He says that in addition to the fact that it is not held in the common view as manifestations of mourning and grief, I'm talking about tatbir and qamazani, or
right.
what the Indians say, talwarzani. So it's not considered a manifestation of mourning and grief, and it has no precedent.
Right.
At the lifetime of the imams, and even after that, and we have not received any tradition quoted from the infallibles
mm-hmm.
about any support for this act, be it privately or publicly, this practice would at the present time give others a bad image of our school of thought. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there is no way that it can be considered permissible.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Once again, I offer my condolences for such a sad occasion and this holy month of Muharram, and remember us wherever you actually pray. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
حسين أبا عبد الله يا منهج يثار الله حسين أبا عبد الله دارك أبد ما ننسى حسين أبا عبد الله يا منهج يثار الله حسين أبا عبد الله دارك أبد ما ننسى
Might aid I do send to your call, I'll stand ready to defend till the very end. For this faith I'll fight, it's the greatest plight. I'll give all my might, I'll serve day and night. Imam, to your call, I will give my all. And if my legs fail me, to you I'll crawl.
حسين أبا عبد الله يا منهج يثار الله حسين أبا عبد الله دارك أبد ما ننسى
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's indiscriminate strikes killed more Palestinians across Gaza, as the total death toll nears 38,850. Far-right Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir tours Al-Aqsa Mosque, drawing anger from Palestinians who see such visits as provocative. And an Israeli drone strike in eastern Lebanon kills a member of the pro-resistance Al-Jama al-Islamiyah party. This is news. Thanks for joining us. We begin this bulletin with Gaza, where Israel's indiscriminate bombing and shelling campaign continues unabated, claiming more civilian lives in the blockaded territory. Nearly two dozen civilians have lost their lives in the latest Israeli airstrikes that targeted several locations across Gaza. One of the attacks happened on Cairo School, housing the displaced Palestinians in Gaza City, resulting in the death of nearly 11 people, including three children. The regime has recently focused its attacks on refugee camps, with the deadliest being Saturday's raid on the Al-Mawasi camp, killing over 90 Palestinians. Israel claimed that Palestinian resistance fighters used these places, but Hamas has denied the accusation, saying the regime is trying to cover up its massacres. The Palestinian death toll since October 7th now stands at around 38,850. Our correspondent Mutaba Musaba joined us earlier from central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala to give us the latest on the situation in the besieged strip.
Let me begin with the appalling massacre that was committed over the last night when the Israeli fighter jets attacked and destroyed a residential building in Al-Zawaida town. At least nine